Hi, everybody. Welcome to Book Tales with Rand Dugas, Heather Fowler, and special guest host Jen Makowski. Today, we are delighted to feature Sequoia Nagamatsu, author of How High We Go in the Dark, published by Bloomsbury Publishing in 2022.
Book Tales, Readings, Cocktails, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Why cocktails? We thought that having a cocktail while listening to your favorite author chat and give a reading would be a fun idea. Today, we are drinking the Bear Claw with a twist inspired by Sequoia's book. The recipe is on the Hot Redhead Media blog, link in the podcast description if you'd like to make it and have one with us.
Sequoia Nagamatsu is the author of How High We Go in the Dark, 2022, and the forthcoming novel, Girl Zero, as well as the story collection, Where We Go When All We Were Is Gone. He is the silver medal winner of the 2016 Forward Review Indies Book of the Year Award and Entropy Magazine Best Book of 2016 and a notable book at BuzzFeed. His work has appeared or is forthcoming in Conjunctions, The Southern Review, Zizova, Tin House, Iowa Review, Lightspeed Magazine, One World, a global anthology of short stories, and others. He teaches creative writing at St. Olaf College and the Rainier Writing Workshop Low Residency MFA program, and lives in Minneapolis with his wife, their cat, their dog, and a robot dog named Calvino. Of How High We Go in the Dark, author Matt Bell says, quote, "This is a book of incredible scope and ambition, a polyphonic elegy for the possible, for all that might be won and lost in the many worlds we make together." Wow, a polyphonic elegy, strong praise.
In 2030, a grieving archaeologist arrives at the Arctic Circle to continue the work of his recently deceased daughter at a crater, where researchers are studying long-buried secrets now revealed in melting permafrost, including the perfectly preserved remains of a girl who appears to have died of an ancient virus. Once unleashed, the Arctic plague will reshape life on Earth for generations to come, quickly traversing the globe, forcing humanity to devise a myriad of moving and inventive ways to embrace possibility in the face of tragedy. In a theme park designed for terminally ill children, a cynical employee falls in love with a mother desperate to hold on to her infected son. A heartbroken scientist searching for a cure finds a second chance at fatherhood when one of his test subjects, a pig, develops the capacity for human speech. A widowed painter and her teenage granddaughter embark on a cosmic quest to locate a new home planet. From funerary skyscrapers to hotels for the dead to interstellar starships, Sequoia Nagamatsu takes readers on a wildly original and compassionate journey, spanning continents, centuries, and even celestial bodies to tell a story about the resilience of the human spirit, our infinite capacity to dream, and the connective threads that tie us all together in the universe.
How are you feeling today, Sequoia?
I'm really glad to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me to talk with you all today.
Yay! And we're so looking forward to talking with you about your work and also having you give us a reading a little bit later. Do you enjoy giving live readings?
I do. I think it's really helpful for readers to kind of get a sense of how authors are perhaps sort of envisioning the words on the page.
I have a question. You mentioned the origin of this novel in the foreword, mentioning the idea for the book beginning in 2008, and you began revising the novel around 2016 with your agent. But it looks like the stories that became chapters started being published around 2009. Can you talk a little bit about the format? Is it a novel in stories, or did you start it out that way when you were drafting, thinking about it like a linked collection? Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think a long history with this book, it really sort of spans my career as a writer to date in a lot of ways. The oldest chapter in the book was initially entitled Melancholy Nights in a Tokyo Internet Cafe, which seems kind of archaic right now in the 21st century. So I updated that to be a virtual cafe. I wrote that story, I think, in about 2008. It was published in the One World, a global anthology of short stories in 2009. And that anthology project was very formative in my career. It really was what helped me decide to pursue writing seriously, attend an MFA program, and write books. At that point, I didn't know this was going to be a book. I didn't even know if I was going to be a writer. I didn't call myself a writer. So the structure of this book really happened very slowly. I would say once I had, at that 2011 mark, I had a few of the chapters already written. I didn't call them chapters back then. They were just individual short stories. But I knew that there were links forming between them. At that point, I assumed it would just be a collection. And it probably wasn't until I started writing a little bit more and all of the different threads of the novel began to converge that I saw this as being a little larger than a traditional story collection, and perhaps even larger than a linked story collection. I believe my agent, when we started working on this together, said that there was a bigness to the book, and it didn't seem quite right to pitch it or call it a story collection. At that point, you know, once we started calling it a novel, I began heightening the connections between chapters and thinking about other major through lines that the reader might be able to appreciate, even if they might not see it at the beginning. Because as Matt Bell's blurb suggests, it's a polyphonic novel. I would call it, you know, kaleidoscopic. And there are certain rewards to reading the book front to back in a way that some people may not read a collection. And there are certain narrative threads that aren't really apparent until you get to that last chapter that forces the reader to think about what they've read previously.
Yeah, I really appreciated that, especially because as I started reading this book, I was like, these are like short stories. Wow. Each of the novels is kind of, you know, functioning independently. And then that's when I looked back and saw that several of them had been published as stories, early editions of the chapters and that sort of thing, which is really wonderful. But I think if I just stop here and note, I think you did a really amazing job of turning what would have been a linked collection into something that does indeed feel like a novel by the time you get done with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I notice sometimes people have an impulse in the publishing industry to call something a novel, whether it's a novel or not. You know, does that make any sense? Because it's more marketable or something like that. And I definitely think you did the work to make this work both ways. So kudos to you. That's amazing.
Thank you very much. Yes, that was certainly, I think, on my mind, looking at books that are actually story collections, but are marketed as novels, and sort of everything in between. And I think that was really a lot of the work that into making would have been a collection into something that I was comfortable calling a novel really happened in the last 2 or 3 years. There was just a lot of revision, thinking about how not only the characters would be interconnected, but how the society of the world would evolve over generations. So thinking about small things like what kind of social media would people be using? What platforms would people be using, you know, 30, 40, 50 years from now? And making sure that those slight touches are there to kind of provide a sense of progression in the world.
Oh, for sure. And when I saw Cliff come back into the narrative, I was like, oh, there he is from chapter one. So I was noticing all of the little linkages that you were creating as I would read through the pieces, while at the same time finding each chapter was kind of satisfying in its own as a bite, or as what I would have conceived of what I would have enjoyed from a short story. And also, I'm kind of a short story junkie, as you may know.
Right.
So I noted, and so of course I'm looking and I'm like, oh, early chapters of this book were published in Redivider, Pleiades, Willow Springs, others. And then I also noted that you noted the Zoetrope workshops as being an early source of inspiration for your career. And being that I spent about 10 years there myself workshopping and have made so many friendships and writing colleagues there as well, I was wondering, hey, can you speak to the role of Zoetrope for your work with short stories or publishing them or creating your identity as an author?
For sure. I mean, I think that's how we sort of internet know each other. The Zoetrope studios, the workshops there, the forum, the private offices, they were incredibly formative for me. I was living in Japan at the time that I think started writing seriously, that I decided to really pick up writing. And, you know, there weren't really any creative writing workshops I could go to when I was living in Japan. So I turned to the internet and I think I stumbled on Zoetrope almost by accident. I didn't even have a computer at the time. I was at the local library in the town that I lived in, Niigata City, and would be engaging with critiques in whatever sort of like rented time I had before I got a new machine in Japan. I mentioned the One World, a global anthology of short stories a little while ago, and I think that was kind of the big thing that really changed my life in a lot of ways. I had published a very, very short story in one of the early online lit mags, Ellie Mae, which you all probably know of.
Yeah.
And so, you know, shout out to Cooper Renner and everybody that helped with that mag. And a Nigerian journalist, a wonderful writer and human being, saw it, Ovo Adaga. he reached out to me and invited me to be part of this anthology project. I didn't know this person at that time. I didn't really understand what he was telling me, keeping in mind that I was very green as a writer and really only had that one online publication to my name. So I was afraid that I didn't want to get taken advantage of. I wasn't really sure if I was good enough, if it was a real thing. And so for a long time, I stood back in this private Zoetrope office, just observing these writers like Patina Gappa and Vanessa Gebbe and Malara Wood and Shabnam Nadia. And I was in awe because they were one older than me, more experienced than me. We were able to nab Chimamanda Adichie and Jhumpa Lahiri to contribute stories to the book. So as somebody who had like one short story to their name, I just felt incredibly lucky to be learning from these writers and having them critique my contribution to the book. So from that point, I really just started, you know, using Zoetrope as my primary workshop space. I got to know several Zoetropers fairly well through the forums and just through critiquing. So, you know, I'm indebted to, writers like Bonnie Zobel.
Oh, I love Bonnie. Yeah. She lives here.
Yeah. Cliff Garstang. And there's so many writers that have kind of just fallen off, and I wish I knew how to contact them, but they were, you know, wherever they are, Barbara Milton, I believe Bernice Fisher passed away a few years ago. They all were very instrumental in my path as a writer.
Sounds like an amazing experience.
So, hey, Sequoia, it's Jen. How are you?
Hi.
I just had to jump in because I wanted to say, I couldn't hold back. When I read the first chapter of a story in the novel, 30,000 Years Beneath a Eulogy, I just was just so struck by how in command that you were with the details. And I was like, wow, this guy has some experience, has some science knowledge. And, you know, I do medical copy editing, so I always appreciate when people really do the research, some of the lab reports and the autopsies. And it struck me because I remember reading Laura Vandenberg's first collection, What the World Will Look Like When All the Water Leaves Us.
Love
and she
that
does
book.
A lot. Yeah, she does a lot with like the South Pole and stuff like that. And she also sounded just had such authority with her details and her settings. And I just remember reading an interview with her and someone asking her, "Well, how did you do all this research? Do you know this stuff?" And she basically said, "You know, like Wikipedia." And it just blew my mind. And I was like, you know, that's the difference, though, between a really good writer and just an okay writer, is that you can totally see like the skeleton when you're reading somebody's story and you see they've just thrown all these details in there and you know they've just Googled something to put that information in there. But for free, when I was reading your stories, I just felt like, yeah, you had such a command of the setting and the universe around you. And I was really in awe of that. So I guess, you know, we wanted to know a little bit more about your process of how you sort of gathered the information and what you used.
Yeah, for sure. Well, first off, yeah, I mean, definitely Wikipedia as at least a jumping off springboard to other resources. But, you know, I'll say that whenever I'm doing research for a story or, you know, for this book, I always do my research way ahead of time, or I never want to have a research session anywhere near a writing session because I want that knowledge to have become an organic part of my being. So that when I'm writing characters and I'm writing world, I'm not tempted to include some fun fact that I think is interesting. The research bits should arise because they need to arise or because that character feels the need to bring it up in a scene. So beyond, you know, Wikipedia, I just spend a lot of time in virtual reality. So obviously some of the chapters kind of nod at VR, but I felt it was just such a rich space for me to at least immerse myself in what a place looks like in a way that is, you know, a little bit better than, you know, Google Maps. So whether that be, you know, quote unquote, walking through a Siberian forest or floating in outer space and taking a closer look at stars and planets, all sort of helped me sort of get into the zone, if you will, of a particular chapter, but also highlight certain features that I wouldn't be able to get from, let's say, a Wikipedia entry, you know, sort of the color of certain trees or foliage. I also spent a lot of time on NASA's website and, you know, looking into the research of climate scientists. And I probably spent a little bit too much time on the NASA Exoplanet website, but I'm a lifelong Star Trek nerd. And so it just astounds me that we are just discovering every day, it seems like, you know, new planets and the possibility of life or even intelligent life on those planets just excites me so much. So, you know, there are aspects of the novel where it's maybe a line or two, but those lines might be the product of maybe a week or two or more research that I was happy to do at the end of the day. I think one instance, I'll give you an example. I read a Goodreads review, and I probably should not be on Goodreads, but one reviewer really appreciated a bit of information about the color of the flora of the foliage on a planet based on the kind of star that the planet was orbiting. And, you know, that's an example of a little factoid that I spent probably more time than I needed to, but I'm glad that it's there because I think science-oriented people or even just people in general might sort of glean the fact that it's a genuine piece of information, even if they can't confirm it right away.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Readers will call you out on that stuff because I had a novel with Black Lawrence as you were also in that press. And I had a line in the novel about Mermaid Avenue being like Woody Guthrie's childhood home, which was incorrect. Mm-hmm. And someone actually wrote to Black Lawrence and set us straight. So, I mean, you do have to be really careful. And there are people there that people who know and care about that stuff.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time,
oh my gosh, even more so with the sci-fi community, which I was really interested in going to ask you about later, because with sci-fi people, they will take it to the bank with correcting something for sure. I mean, like you will write something 6 books ago and they will be, but this character in the earliest book said this, you know, and oh, craziness. So, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt if I was interrupting anybody. And speaking of which, I wanted to add another note because I often think about when you're genre straddling, right? Because your book has a really literary feel, but it also, in some respects to me, feels like a fusion of like, I don't know if you're familiar with Ken Liu, author of The Paper Menagerie, George Saunders, and gosh, who's the other author? There's another author, like a combo of all of these authors doing very different things. And how do you feel that your fusion of genres is impacting what you're choosing to do and or what your audience is?
Well, I think that fusion is really just an integral part of my identity as a writer. I don't think I could write any other way, honestly. You know, again, I mentioned like my lifelong love is Star Trek. So that's there. I was always kind of sort of like a history anthropology buff, and I majored in anthropology in college. I'm somebody that really likes to sort of puzzle through stories. I really love experimental formal innovation. And I think a lot of the labels, you mentioned Ken Liu and George Saunders, whenever we talk about who is a genre writer or who is not, there are certainly some conventions when we think about what a hard sci-fi story is versus something that might be a quote-unquote light sci-fi novel. But if you take a look at literary journals and genre journals, over the years, these boundaries have been chipped away, where you might find stories in, let's say, the best American science fiction and fantasy anthology that are culled from very literary journals like the Iowa Review or Paris Review and journals that you might expect like Asimov's and the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. I've given this lecture a couple of times at a few places now on just the nature of genre. You know, in a nutshell, for me, it's oftentimes when we're talking about genre labels, we're talking about communities. Instead, communities just as much as what the writer is actually producing. So where did I rise as a writer? You know, who is my network? I've certainly published in genre publications like Lightspeed Magazine, but the majority of my publications are very literary publications. The fact that I have an MFA also might kind of send smoke signals, you know, they might signal to the reader that my writing might be of a certain particular bent, or they just might have certain preconceptions of the kind of writing I do, whether that's true or not. So I'm not sure like what I'm comfortable being called. I actually answered this question earlier for an email interview, and they asked me if I'm more comfortable being called a science fiction writer or a speculative writer. And I know in the past, Margaret Atwood has really distanced herself from the term sci-fi and has chosen to kind of create her own definition of the word speculative. in that, you know, she's speculating based on kind of given information on what could be. At this juncture, I would say, you know, I'm probably the most comfortable with speculative as a definition, not because I agree with a lot of these categories, but mostly because I understand that readers and bloggers and reviewers seem to have labeled speculative as science fiction with a literary bent. You know, if I really needed to describe myself and what I produce, that's relatively accurate.
And it's so funny that you mentioned this too, because I think a lot of creating new terms to use for genres has to do with literary elitism. It's the same thing to mm-hmm. me, like, you know, how people say if they say they're magical realists, then it's still technically part of the literary branch of the house as opposed to the genre branch of the house. Just because there's so much kind of prejudice about genre fiction that sometimes is absolutely not warranted. Sometimes right. the genre fiction is just as smart, just as beautifully crafted. And when I was talking about The Paper Menagerie with Ken Yu Liu, that was the book of his that occurred to me as that. But also I forgot to mention, I meant to add Haruki Murakami.
Yeah.
So imagine that combo, right?
Right.
Haruki Murakami, George Saunders, and Ken Yu. You like have like this beautiful, perfect animal right there.
Yeah.
Because I enjoy all of those authors so much. And I really enjoy things that do things that kind of make intersections between the types of things that they do. So this was all leading up to this other question I have, which is that I see you also have another novel forthcoming called Girl Zero. So that's speaking to me too. Is that also going to be a speculative type?
Yeah, it's kind of in that wheelhouse as well. And I don't think there's a cassette date. I think it's slated for something like 2024, also with William Morrow and Bloomsbury. That's also a novel. I guess the idea behind that novel is also sort of like a long time coming. It was sort of the novel that I thought was going to be my MFA thesis, but I ended up producing a story collection. Probably because I was still kind of in this space of not really having encountered the books that I needed to at that point to learn how to write that novel. Yeah. And I think I was still uncertain as to the texture of the novel, how hard genre or soft genre I wanted it to be. The story, in a nutshell, centers around a mother and a father who tragically lose their daughter. And in this world, mythical creatures have existed in our past and are kind of on the brink of extinction. They're extraordinarily rare. The father decides to replace their deceased daughter with a genetic copy and seeks out a rare shape-shifting creature in Japan. He drops a bit of hair on this creature and the creature becomes their daughter. So it becomes this, the primary thread is ultimately about identity formation. It's following this facsimile girl as she's being trained and coached to be the daughter that, you know, this couple lost, while also having to come to terms with the person that, you know, she's becoming herself, well aware that she's not their daughter, but the fact that she is growing to love her mother and father as if they were actually her parents. And the story is also about certainly the grief of parents and how both the mother and father characters are evolving as they are raising this daughter, full well knowing in the back of their minds that their real daughter has died.
Wow, that sounds just amazing. Your work kind of reminds me of also Kazuo Ishiguro, because he has sort of, he sort of goes back and forth, and that has a very like, you know, never let me go kind of vibe. And I love that, you know, it feels almost like, and it's, I think because of the proliferation of literary journals in the past 10, 15 years, I feel like we're almost in a post-genre world. Like the only reason we're still kind of holding on is because people need like that keyword in Amazon so they can keep finding that, reading that same book over and over and over. But for most people, I feel like we just want to be somewhere where we can tackle like speculative and literary or black comedy and this or that. And I think at least, you know, with my work as a literary journal editor, I see that a lot in our submissions. And we've revised our submission guidelines to the point where we're just like, we don't really publish nonfiction, but we like, if it has good characters in it, we don't care what it is. You know, it could be a
different story. Send it all.
Yes, yeah, send everything. We just want a good story. And I think a lot of, especially because of the writing programs, I mean, people have varied interests and they're being funneled into a literary perspective of it. But then they're coming out and they're writing all sorts of different, crazy, beautiful things in different genres very like wonderfully. And then I wondered if that's something that you experience also as the editor of Psycho Pump Mag, and how your work sort of intersects with your own writing life, your work as an editor, what you see and how you react to it.
Yeah, my wife and I, we met in grad school. We started Psychopomp, I think, initially because, you know, it doesn't seem that long ago, but 2012, 2013, we felt that there just weren't a lot of journals publishing the weird experimental work that we loved. I mean, the journals existed, but we felt that there was a kind of gap that if you were getting into Tin House or Conjunctions or The New Yorker, you can do whatever the hell you want. But there didn't seem to be a lot of journals for writers that were just starting out or writers kind of in sort of that middle phase of their sort of lit journal career to send out work like that. And so we decided to start out Psychopomp magazine to support innovative work, genre bending work, work that was formally playful, experimental, whatever you want to call it. Over the years, I think we've been, I think, very blessed to get to publish, you know, so many wonderful writers that have gone on to have amazing careers. We've published Anne Valenti. We've published a story by Raven Lenlani before Lester. A lot of the work that we get, I think, is, I would say that maybe 20% of it is appropriate for us. I think we're, in some ways, if you don't read the magazine, we're a hard journal to peg. And which is why the very common advice is to read at least an issue or at least read a few samples of literary magazine, I think certainly applies to us. Because if you've read Psychopomp, a reader would quickly realize that we do not necessarily publish what could be described as hard genre. We do not necessarily publish realist fiction. We are very squarely in the middle of those spheres. And on top of that, we tend to publish shorter, language-driven, very poetic pieces to the point where some writers have almost called us a prose poetry magazine.
Wow. Expanding on Jen's question a little bit, I wanted to talk some more about your role as an editor, but also your work as an author, as a teacher, and how does changing those hats work in your world? And just curious if one is more time-consuming, one is more gratifying, and how does that work for you?
Well, I think we're also kind of leaving another sort of piece here is, I guess, in addition to the editing, I also teach. I guess beyond that, you know, my wife and I also sort of mentor in various capacities. I would say, you know, during the academic year, teaching probably takes the lion's share of my time. Yeah. And, you know, I remember in an interview for when I was still on the market, a committee asked me, how do you balance a writer life and the life of a professor? How do you maintain that balance? And I was honest and I said that you don't. And I think they appreciated the answer because it's true. You don't balance those things. You make compromises when you can and you need to. And when you have time, you devote to your writing, or you set yourself up to be in a place where you can dive into the writing in those spare moments, you know, really taking advantage of summers and breaks, you know, those moments on the weekends, so that if there's time during the week, you don't have to spend so much time getting into the zone, if you will, you'll be able to sort of really take advantage of that half hour or hour. But I also don't see teaching, grading maybe, but I don't see teaching as taking away from kind of the writer life, because I'm honestly, you know, when I'm thinking about putting together a syllabus, I'm choosing books that I want to read. I'm choosing books that I find interesting, that I think would be challenging for not only my students, but also myself. I think being a creative writing professor is also wonderful because it's forcing me to teach and really dive deep into work that I would not choose to read myself if left to my own devices. So it's really helping me to hold on to a breadth of literature and be very open-minded when it comes to other stylistic choices. And I think that only strengthens my own writing at the end of the day.
Yeah. And I'm a teacher too. Conversations with students, things that come up in class, sometimes that can be really inspiring. Grading papers, no, never really inspired from that.
Yeah.
So speaking of inspiring, can you tell us a bit about the publishing journey that you went on with How High We Go in the Dark with your agent? I mean, I know it. You wound up signing with William Morrow for a 2-book deal. And how is it different from like your first book, Where We Go When We sure. All Were Is Gone, which was published by Black Lawrence?
Right. Well, I guess I'll start off with Where We Go and While We Were Is Gone. At least Girl Zero has a shorter title. But I did query agents for that book as well. And I think in retrospect, I realized why that book didn't get picked out by agents. I had wonderful conversations about Where We Go when I queried. Some agents were reaching out to me just based on story publications. So the conversations were already happening kind of in terms of agents and talking to larger publishers even at that stage. But it's a short book, too short to be commercial. It's very formally weird. And I think in retrospect, you know, a small press was going to be the best home for it. And I'm really glad that Diane Gottl at Black Lawrence picked it out of the slush when she did, because I really needed a book to apply to tenure track jobs. And before she called, I didn't have one. And I was at a visiting position in Idaho with no other or very few things I could apply to at that point. So it really kind of gave me the life that I have in a lot of ways. So I'm very thankful for Where We Go. But being a small press, there's just a lot of realities that I think writers publishing with small presses need to acknowledge, is that the marketing and sort of sales machine is going to be very, very different. A small press cannot afford to be sending hundreds, if not, you know, close to 1,000 advanced review copies to newspapers and magazines and bloggers and influencers. That's just not going to happen. And you can do some of that work on your own. But again, if you're a first-time author, you're not going to have a lot of those connections. And you're probably not going to even know how to pitch some of these places. And if you do, the other thing that is an unfortunate reality is that a lot of outlets, a lot of review outlets, a lot of influencers will not give small presses the time of day. And I kind of learned that the hard way. I spent a lot of my own money just sending out copies and sending out pitches.
Yeah.
And a lot of it was just radio silence. So I am really glad that and thankful to those people that responded to me and, you know, helped give Where We Go a leg up. But a lot of people just didn't respond. And tell one anecdote here that kind of really drives home how the playing field is very uneven. Years after I published Where We Go, BuzzFeed tapped the book as one of the best books that you haven't read. One of those lists, and Where We Go sold out, like immediately. Cleared out of Amazon, cleared out of small press distribution. Diane had to do another print run. And it occurred to me, like, wow, what would have happened if I had that kind of attention at the beginning? It would have just been a very different journey for that book. And that's what I'm seeing with How High We Go. In addition to being published by William Morrow and Bloomsbury, I'll just be up front and say it was a big deal. It was not a small book deal. And as such, it was sort of seen as more of a priority title for both Bloomsbury and William Morrow, which translated to more attention with publicity and sales. And it's kind of mind-boggling to me, like a couple weeks out before the book is even published, that there's almost 40,000 people that added it to their Goodreads shelf. And I'm popping up in review outlets and lists and getting reviewed in places like the Scientific American. If I were left to my own devices, I would not know how to even begin reaching out for those possibilities. So I'm very thankful to the work that everybody at William Morrow and Bloomsbury is doing for me, and say that any success, and I think anybody publishing with a big five, you know, has to be honest that any success that a book has, yeah, it's partly you, it's your book, but a lot of what's happening in terms of getting a book in the bookstore and in front of readers is largely the sales and publicity teams. And unfortunately, small presses often don't have those teams. It's usually just one person, if they have that person at all.
But I think writing gets you in the door too, because there are a lot of books that I've read that were really highly hyped. And I finished them and I was like, oh, or my, you know, my book group, we'd read them and be like, but then, you know, you get the first two stories in your book and I was like, this is going to be huge. And it was like, I don't think I have enough syllables in there. It was like, huge, you know, this is going to be, you probably already like sold like options and stuff. This, your book is incredibly good. I mean, you put up and you did it. I mean, it wasn't just like, it's the hype that's driving it. It's the writing that's driving it, because.
Yeah, but to be fair, to Sequoia's point, I think one of the larger problems that indie presses have is they don't have the distribution. I mean, it's not just the outlets that are going to review it, because to me, reviews don't sell books. It's not about reviews. It's about eyes on the book, yeah, so BuzzFeed, but it's also about from the minute Sequoia, your press already probably had, you know, 40,000 copies of your book sold before anyone had ever read it, right? I mean, because you're a big publisher. So I think that's a factor too for these larger books that have the bigger presses. They just have better placement, better product placement, better alignment.
Sure. I just didn't want Sequoia to sell himself short because it's an incredible book.
Thank you for that.
It's going to sell because you wrote a damn good book.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, I'm a Capricorn, so I tend to downplay things. But yeah, I mean, I agree with that as well. But just kind of like thinking about the comparison between small presses and large presses, it is a distribution. If the writing's there, you can write the best book in the world. But if people don't see it, then it's not going to ever get that kind of attention. I'm not sure like how accurate these numbers are, because I know sometimes the numbers are inflated. But I know Library Journal, you know, one of the industry publications, noted that my initial print run was 100,000 copies, mm-hmm. which, you know, is on the high end. It could be higher. I've seen higher, but it's on the higher end. That number alone is telling librarians, it's telling booksellers that it's going to be a big book without any having been put out yet.
Yes, which is what's extra gratifying when we see someone who has done all of the paths. It's extra gratifying for me anyway, when I see someone who has busted their butt, worked really hard, written beautiful work, had it been accepted by all kinds of wonderful journals, actually had a publication with an indie press so they know the difference. It probably must be extra special for you when they're doing these extra promotions for this book, being that you've seen both sides of the fence now.
Yeah, no, it's definitely very special, and I feel very appreciative. And I'll just add one thing, that my journey in publication, a lot of it goes back to Zoetrope. It's, I think, largely the community that has, I think, helped me along the way. I think it would be a very different experience for a writer that was kind of just lone wolfing it to a degree, and maybe that book would still be very successful because, you know what, money talks and corporations talk. But I think for me, what really helped was the fact that I have been part of the literary community for a while now, and even before Where We Go. But I think having Where We Go as an excuse to really get to know my fellow writers and go to these smaller festivals and travel and talk to somebody's MFA class or undergrad class, and just hanging out on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook made a difference. I think in my deal letter from Bloomsbury, they noted that they liked that. They liked that it seemed like I was a fairly connected person. And from the outside, I think a newer writer might think I'm like some kind of weird insider, but I didn't have any advantages going in. I didn't live in New York. I didn't have famous friends or anything of that sort. I didn't have agent friends. A lot of that was just being there, supporting other writers, and existing in the online lit space. I think that counts for a lot.
Oh, for sure. And also, I think I've seen some people who have been debut novelists who didn't have that time in the community, not quite have that larger view. So, and not be able to have colleagues you can commiserate with if you get these terrible reviews, so to speak.
Right.
Because even the most famous authors can have a book that just doesn't do well. And in mm-hmm. the end, if that happens, your community is where you fall back, right?
Right,
it's where
right.
You gain your solace to continue, so to speak. Speaking of grief, but in a different dimension connected to your book. So I noted that grief was just so huge in this book. Coping with grief, being the one left outside or an outsider, really resonates in a lot of the chapters of this book for me. And I felt also that the overwhelming presence of death in a pandemic/post-pandemic world were there for me too. So were there themes you wanted the reader to come away with regarding death and survival and loss? Yeah, I'll stop there.
I mean, I think, you know, certainly there is a lot of death and sadness in the book, but I also wanted to be very cognizant of the fact that even in the most devastating chapters, there would still be glimmers of hope and light that the character could reach towards, even if it was very small. I hope that the reader sort of senses that the hope and the light does grow as you approach the end of the novel. And that hope often sort of takes the form of acknowledging the connections that we have in our lives, whether that's thinking about the past and cherishing memories of people, whether that's creating new bridges with people that exist in your own life or could exist in your own life, and really embracing community as a way of moving beyond that grief and moving beyond some kind of devastation. So I think beyond the grief and the death, I think community is kind of another thread that I would want readers to take away, a community, hope in the form of community.
Oh, yeah, definitely. One of my favorite parts of the book is kind of the cognitive dissonance I feel like the character Rena has over wanting to be accepted after the long absence from her old world and missing part mm-hmm. of her Baba's life and passing, but plus the world building you do there of missing a cultural connection with traditions of her family's world and yet wanting to escape it sort of and them in a weird way. At any rate, there's just so much of that there for me. But we are really looking forward to hearing you read from the book. So let's go ahead and move toward that. But first, let's have Rand tell us about today's cocktail, which was custom created for this book.
Today's booktail cocktail is called Bear Claw with a Twist, and it was inspired from the drinking game in your first story. The recipe's on the blog if you'd like to make a drink and enjoy it while you listen at home. Here are the ingredients. It's 1 ounce of pineapple juice, 1/2 ounce of hibiscus simple syrup, 1 ounce of vodka, 2 ounces of beer, 1/2 ounce of lime. Put the ingredients in the shaker with ice, give it a shake, and strain into a glass with more ice. Garnish with a lime wedge or a pineapple. It's really delicious.
That sounds wonderful. I'll have to make that later on today.
Yeah.
If you want to be a purist while you're reading that first chapter, though, just get a chilled bottle of vodka, get a glass and pour it. And there you go.
I know, but I had to do a little something with it.
I'm going to read just a couple of pages from a chapter called Pig Son.
Excellent. Take it away.
After my ex-wife mailed half of my son's ashes to me in an urn, I committed myself to growing the hearts and other organs that might have saved him inside of pigs. It's Fitch's birthday today, which means Dory texts me more than usual, which is pretty much never. Do you remember how I told you that he'd like to fall asleep hugging his new collection of comic books? I've forgotten what he smelled like. I never respond to these messages. Dory doesn't really want a conversation. She still blames me for not being there in the end. She's never understood how hard I fought trying to save him. A real conversation would be too painful. It's the same reason I've never addressed Fitch's failed transplant in my peer-reviewed articles. His file sits inside my desk rather than among the lab's program records, like a lost statistic. My graduate assistant, Patrice, is shouting through the intercom, telling me to come to the lab quickly. I hear another voice I don't recognize, muffled and nasal and a little bit frantic, repeating the word doctor as if it's trying to convey an entire thought with a single word. I pull on my face mask and lab coat, open the outer door of my office. My staff is gathered around one of the glass holding pens where we keep our organ donor pigs. The pigs are all destined to help infected people like my son, whose organs have given way to the plague. The timing is crucial, though. We need to reach the infected before they slip into the comas that mark the advanced stages of the illness. This one, donor 28, was nicknamed Snotorious P.I.G., after an intern put a gold chain and shades on him during a Halloween party. The pig studies me as I approach, wiggling its behind, and barely opens its mouth. Doctor. The sound seems disembodied, like a ventriloquist is throwing their voice. Okay, very funny, I say, turning to my staff. Who said that? They look at each other, and Patrice points back to the pen. We think it's Notorious, she says. Okay, sure. Forget that these pigs lack the necessary vocal cords for human speech, even if we have genetically modified them for accelerated growth and organ donor optimization. Doctor, this time the pig's mouth doesn't move at all. I'm starting to get annoyed, but there's something about the voice. Again, I say, I hop into the pen, nearly sliding on a piece of shit, and kneel, looking into the animal's blue eyes. Say it. Doctor, he says. Jesus. The pig's strange voice, like a mouth filled with cotton balls, reverberates in my mind. After several more tests, there is no mistaking it. The pig's brain, not quite human and not quite swine, lights up like a firecracker on the MRI whenever he speaks. This does not leave the building. Not yet, I say. We need to know what we have here, and we don't want someone else taking him away. The staff simply nods, but that isn't good enough for me. I need to hear you say it. Yes, I won't say a word. Yes, I won't say a word, they repeat in unison, like we're in a grade school. Okay, good. But this isn't some top secret facility. There are no security clearances or repercussions here. The grad students were suspect even before the outbreak, swiping medical supplies for God knows what. I worry it's only a matter of time. We divide the days between working with Snotorious and fulfilling our hospital organ orders. I pay Patrice's sister, Ami, a speech therapist, to assist us in our research. We clear out one of the lab rooms to create a study play area for Snotorious. We set up a television and a computer equipped with programmed paddle buttons specifically modified for pig feet. I dig through my attic for my son's old books and toys. Doctar, it's no surprise the word he heard the most around the lab would be his first. When Ami and I work with him in his room, we break lab protocol and remove our masks and gloves. He seems to soak up everything we share with him. Flashcards, cartoons, children's books, including The Three Little Pigs and Charlotte's Web. We treat him like a child, though it's hard to say where his mind is at any given moment. Ami gives him treats, gold stars. Positive reinforcement is important, she says. He's learning so fast. At first, he has a new favorite word each day. Sheep, horse, farmer, bus, yellow, mud, Ami. Mornings and evenings, he screams the word hungry or makes a specific request from his rapidly growing vocabulary. Apple, he says one morning. Please. The other day, he told Patrice, thank you. After he finished eating, good pig. He favors reruns of the Crocodile Hunter show on Animal Planet, snorting excitedly whenever he sees a hippo. He also has a fascination with rocket launches, the test flights for manned missions to Mars that somehow always seem a decade away. He counts down with a mission control before running excitedly around the room at liftoff. We try to change the station whenever something disturbing comes on. Neglected and starving farm animals whose owners have died, rotting crops, the displaced clambering onto relief cruise ships after wildfires drove them from their homes. But he's seen the reports of hospital plague wards overflowing into trailers and parking lots and airport hangars. Sick people. Sick people. Doctor, help. He's seen the funerary industry take over our banking system, the footage of people paying for food at the grocery store with mortuary cryptocurrencies tied to ad-ridden phone apps. Come laugh with us at the City of Laughter, Sartorius repeats like a mantra until he can form the words. Come laugh with us at City of Laughter. For only 1,000 bereavement crypto tokens, you can scatter your loved one's ashes on a one-hour cruise around San Francisco Bay. And then tonight, right as I'm about to leave the lab, I hear Sartorius say a new word, lonely. I approach his playroom and sit with him, scratching behind his ears. Lonely pig, he says. My phone buzzes, it's my ex again, a photo of Fitch holding a giant stuffed tiger on his final day. Sartorius repeats himself, and I feel guilty for having given him this life, one that would have ended weeks ago had he remained silent. A heart to Indiana, a liver to Michigan, lungs to Washington, D.C. Of course, we've made other arrangements, sent other pigs. But something tugs at me as he speaks. I think about how when I go home, I'll heat up a microwave dinner, curl up in bed, watch one of the few videos I have of Fitch, a 2-minute clip of him building a sandcastle, over and over again, until I fall asleep. Instead, I grab the sleeping bag I keep in my office for when I'm burning the midnight oil, and decide to keep Mr. Sartorius company. I'll stop there.
Wow, that was really great. I'm so enjoyed hearing you read that aloud, because that was my favorite story in the collection, and I love Sartorius Pig. I was before the podcast, he was my favorite character. And it was funny because I shut the book and I started to cry. And I was just like, I don't know if I can, if they're all going to be like this, I don't know if I can continue it. The book was really heavy. I mean, it was really, as someone who hasn't really processed or cried during this last 2 years of the pandemic, it felt good to have that outlet for something unexpected like that. But I know when you were writing these stories, you also talked about how your grandfather's death was a big influence on your writing this book. So it made me wonder about, in addition to grief being a big theme for this book, were there other themes that you were grappling with as you were writing these stories?
I mean, I think early on, grief was certainly part of it. I think more particularly reimagining grief and thinking about alternative ways that we grieve. I think in the Western cultures, particularly generally in the 21st century, it's become a very taboo thing to talk about death or mortality. And I think a lot of that's honestly a function of capitalism. When somebody dies that you love, you're not really given the space to grieve in the way that we might have generations ago. Your first concern is money. How much is the hospital going to cost? How much is the funeral going to cost? You become an event planner when you don't want to be. And so, you know, our modern ways of death have really become very materialistic, very finance oriented. And we don't really get to think about what happens to us when we die. We don't get to interact with faith if you have one. We don't get to honor the memories of those have passed. And so a lot of the alternative ways of grieving that the chapters explore were at least, you know, part of my explorations in wanting to give that back to my characters.
Oh, I definitely felt that. I definitely felt the commerce culture of death was hugely moving through so many of the pieces here. But also in terms of modern culture, I really felt like the loneliness of relationships conducted by electronic communications was a big thing too. Like how distancing these could be was so much an important theme for me. Like in the chapter where Akira and Yoshiko, the young man and the older merchant woman who meet in an electronic kind of virtual world. It's like the young man wants to meet her and be in real world space with her, but she doesn't want that. And so they can't have comfort in the real world. But then that happens in a lot of the narratives. But then that seems to me like it also came across in a lot of the narratives, like when some of the characters would communicate via letters or remembering their family by recorded memories or robot dogs. So it seemed like the intimacy of characters is shown to increase whenever they can actually discuss grief or shame in the real world and be present in that real world place with other characters. Did you want to speak to maybe that, the modernity movement coming through?
For sure. Yeah, that's exactly right. A lot of your points kind of hit the nail on the head is in terms of, I think, the complexity of how we communicate. Social media has changed us. I think probably it's changed us in, I think, dramatic ways, in ways that we probably can't even articulate yet.
Yeah.
When my father died about a year ago, one of the first things I did after I was kind of just stunned and sort of staring at the wall was to tweet about it, because it was a knee-jerk reaction, honestly. And I was surprised that I was tweeting about my father's death so soon after having heard the news. But for me, online space was kind of like the village, right? And having people that I both know in real life and perfect strangers telling me about their experiences and comforting me was something that I needed, and something that maybe I even expected from social media. So when I was writing How High We Go in the Dark, I really wanted to grapple with this weird space of social media both bringing people together, but also social media and technology. Still, when we kind of dig deep, it still is a very distant way of communicating. It's given rise to important activist movements, but it's also given rise to a kind of anonymity that is at the crux of a lot of hatred, arguments, and misconceptions on places like Twitter and Facebook. When somebody is able to allow themselves to step away from technology, you know, in the case of Akira, actually begin living his life again, it's kind of a breath of fresh air. And I don't want some of these chapters to sound like they're anti-technology, because a lot of the technologies in, you know, this book are providing comfort, but there needs to be a point where you turn the machine off, where you turn your app off and acknowledge where you are emotionally. Talk to your father, talk to your mother, talk to your friends, or at least just step out into the world.
Oh, for sure. I really liked that element. But I also liked the element of how many Asian and Asian American characters you were able to bring such real life and intimacy with in this book. And I read in the book itself, you had mentioned that kind of seeing the racism and the stuff that was going on at the start of the pandemic might have impacted what you were doing with some of the narratives. Can you speak to that for a second?
Sure. You know, so for my first collection, you know, obviously a lot of the characters there were Japanese nationals because it was largely set in Japan. For this book, I wanted to make sure that a lot of the characters, if not most of them, were explicitly Asian American or Asian, or at least assumed to be. And when I was editing the novel, after several months of the COVID pandemic having already been underway, I really wanted to make sure that the Asian characters were omnipresent throughout, but that in my revisions, I never privileged Asian identity. And I remember telling my agent that, you know, when I was thinking about how this book would be pitched as we were approaching publishers, that I didn't want it to be an Asian novel. I didn't want people to see it as an Asian novel just because I have a Japanese last name. I wanted this book to be a platform for Asian bodies and Asian voices, but I wanted readers to acknowledge that these characters were just people going through a very terrible tragedy and surviving just like anybody else, and certainly victims of a terrible tragedy. When I first started writing, there weren't very many Asian or Asian American authors writing about my experience. I'm a third, maybe even a fourth, I guess, depending on how you count, generation Japanese American. You know, my great grandmother came to Hawaii before Hawaii was even a state in the early part of the 20th century for an arranged marriage. So her story was the story of immigration. My grandfather was in an internment camp during World War II. So war was his story. For me, I grew up in Hawaii and California, very disconnected in a lot of ways from my Japanese heritage. And it wasn't really until recently I started to see more and more television shows, even literature, that starred people that were about people that just happened to have Asian faces, but were highly Americanized. And that's something that I wanted to contribute to in this book to some degree as well.
I have a question that kind of connects to that. I was interested in the role of folklore, mm-hmm. and in particular, Japanese folklore, and what role it played in your novel, if you could talk about that a little bit.
I would say that, I mean, not nearly to the degree that it played in my first book. I would say not so much folklore as the confluence of Japanese traditions and modern Japan, and particularly modern Japan's relationship with technology. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think there's always kind of a subtext when we're thinking about Japanese identity that really kind of goes as far back as to the first interactions Japan had with the West in the late 1800s, where old rituals, the world of temples, the old gods started to take a back seat to Christianity, to technology, to wanting to become an empire. And certainly after World War II, having to really reimagine what Japanese identity meant in the face of destruction, and that became technology. And so there's always this dialogue that we see in anime and manga and a lot of Japanese literature that is this hearkening back to a traditional past that the Japanese people cannot fully go back to, and having a very, I think, love-hate relationship in some ways with the technology that has, you know, that we often identify with that country and with that culture. So if you look at a very important anime and manga like Akira, technology becomes this monstrous thing. It becomes this monstrous entity. In another, I think, relatively famous anime, Serial Experiments Lane, we see the internet, the World Wide Web, becoming this monstrous entity. And I kind of wanted to sort of like nod at some of those things, some of those tensions, not necessarily monstrous, but the tensions of the traditional life and modernity, the 21st century and beyond, especially in chapters like Brave Friends and Speaks Fetch, Say I Love You.
I love that answer. And I just love all these perspectives that you're giving us. And it's just, I wonder if there's something, if there are any new writers out there, or even just other authors listening, if there's something you can kind of encapsulate, like on your path so far to being where you are now as an author, like what advice, what did you learn? And what advice would you give to other authors?
I mean, I would just say to be true to yourself, which sounds like such a hackneyed thing, but I think oftentimes when writers begin writing, they're not writing for themselves. They're writing because they think there's a certain brand of story is considered serious literature, or is, you know, considered popular in whatever niche they happen to be in. So write the story that you want to write. And if you feel like you need help in writing it, or don't feel like you have the chops in writing that story, acknowledge that and be fine with that, because you're always going to be, to some degree, playing catch up with your idea, the concept that's in your head, and the skill that you actually have at that current moment. And the only thing that can help kind of bridge that gap between the concept that is really getting you excited, that's residing in your head, and the skill that you actually have, is just reading widely. Because while you might be reading a lot of, let's say that you're a fantasy writer, a lot of fantasy, the thing that might help you the most is reading a very understated realist fiction about, let's say, a couple in Nebraska. You'll be incredibly surprised about where the tools reside that are going to make you a better writer. And I think for me, I was very resistant early on and kind of just widening my reading. And I think teaching in a lot of ways kind of helped force me to encounter books that I wouldn't have encountered otherwise. So I would say be true to yourself in terms of the kind of writer that you want to be, read widely, and maybe lastly, be kind to others in the literary space, whether that be online or in person. You don't want to be transactional by any means. You want to be a part of a community in a very organic way. And I think that has its own rewards when the time comes, because people want to help you, not because, you know, you're asking for favors and nobody knows who you are.
That's wonderful advice. Really good. Thank you so much for spending time with us today. We enjoy talking to you and hearing you read from your book.
Thank you very much for having me.
It was so fun to chat with you. Yes. And it feels like How High We Go is a seminal book about grief and a philosophical one too. So everyone out there, please order Sequoia's book, How High We Go in the Dark, and be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on the booktales, readings, and drinks. Also, subscribe to this podcast, which releases once a month, for more conversation with amazing literary authors. Thanks again for listening to Book Tales. See you next time.